were gathered to one side, sprawled upon the grass as they watched him, and he witnessed how deeply entwined Amadou and Aliza were in this community, staying close to the others. He reported on the progress of the investigation, trying not to sound officious. When he'd finished, he offered the words he found most difficult to relate. He'd rehearsed them in his head, and he'd asked Diana Shahada for her advice, but in the end, they'd both agreed. Though they wanted to calm the fears of the community, reassurance would have been dishonest. "We believe the shooter is still at large and may be armed. I advise you to stay away from the mosque and to avoid any other public gatherings for now. Though I appreciate the need for community at the moment, it places your children in danger." As he'd expected, there was an angry murmur from the students. One of the young men challenged him. He identified himself as Rami, Yusuf Sufyan's brother.
"They have claimed our families and our mosque. Now you're asking us to hide from their hatred? We won't do it. We're not afraid."
"You should be," Issa said grimly. "I know I am." Ignoring Rami for the moment, he turned to the women in attendance, all of whom were veiled for prayer. "Sisters, those of you who cover outside your homes, I urge you to travel in larger groups, preferably with a male member of your family."
"So this new French secularism, this code of conduct secularism, is one that imprisons our sisters at home? Is this what they call liberation?"
Issa stifled a sigh at Rami's words, but before he could determine what to say, Aliza stood up, allowing her veil to flutter to her shoulders. A warm recognition passed over the faces of the students in the group.
"The shooting was an act of terror, Rami, and the terrorist is still at large."
With a painful twist in her voice, she added,
"Your parents can't afford to lose another son."
And she stood there and recited the names of the dead until a pool of silence blossomed over the night. Chapter 60. Diana Shahada found Issa a little later, sitting at a small round table in the garden, waiting for Amadou and Aliza to join him. He'd moved through the crowd, speaking to each member of the small community, listening carefully to anything they needed to share about their grief. Consoling the families of the dead was not a new experience for him, yet rarely had he known a community struck so deeply and so hard. They exchanged phrases in Arabic, and even when Issa couldn't understand what was said, it was the language itself that brought comfort. Its lulling, rhythmic cadences, its history as a sacred tongue that could connect him instantly to any Arabic speaker at any time or place across the globe.
"I think that helped," Diana said. She brought over a plate of appetizers, and companionably they shared the meal as she told him what the MCLU had set in motion when she'd gone to Ottawa.
They'd issued a constitutional challenge to the Code of Conduct and to Bill 62, citing violations of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the supreme law of the land.
"Beyond constitutional issues, we need this case to be prosecuted as an act of terrorism, with hate crimes added to the indictment."
Moodily, Khattak said,
"We haven't caught the killer yet. We can't say with certainty that hate was the motive here."
Instead of getting angry, as he expected, Diana looked at him with pity.
"Oh, Issa, haven't you faced it yourself?"
He surprised himself by giving her an honest response.
"I don't think I want to. There are times when I need to look away."
Her voice was still soft when she said, "You can't. None of us can anymore."
She waved at someone on the other side of the garden. He looked up and saw Amadou, whose great dark eyes reflected his own sense of melancholy.
The dusk prayer would always break Issa's heart. The difference was that the weight of it was deeper. He took a long sip of his drink. "What will you say in the morning at Isabelle Clément's press conference?" A smile touched Diana's lips. "Thank you for getting me invited to that, by the way. I think I might take her a little by surprise."
Issa's own smile turned wry.
"She promised me that this is one conference that won't go off the rails." With a touch of asperity, Diana said, "I won't say anything beyond the things this country needs to hear." But when she put her hand on his, he recognized it as a gesture of fellowship. They were both on the same side now. They would have to be, until they could fight their way through. "Do you remember when you were offered the job, director of community policing? You called me and we talked into the night." A slight smile curved his lips. "You had so many doubts, so many concerns about all the different ways you might be used. I asked you what you wanted to achieve."
"I remember."
Though, in truth, he'd forgotten how generous Diana had been, becoming more and more closed off so that each of them had gone on to fight their battles alone. "You said you wanted to achieve whatever measure of justice you could for communities just like ours, and I said you should take the job. Do you remember why?" Years had passed since that conversation had taken place, but now he recalled her words with a shiver of premonition. She had predicted the fallout from the rise of groups like the Allegiance. Conditioning, she'd call it, but what she'd said had cracked open the truth like a thin and jagged spike. "You have to do this," she'd said. "What we're facing is just the beginning."
Chapter 61. Aliza couldn't eat with the others at the gathering. She was too tense, and her stomach was still roiling from her confrontation with Max, and now from the sense that she'd forfeited Issa's trust. Perhaps because she'd insisted on heading to the vigil in the woods, or maybe because she'd accused him of using her to give him cover. There was also a chance that he might have drawn back because Seher Hilzey didn't like her. She pushed a heavy wing of hair from her face, finding a corner of the Soufiane's garden where she could speak to Amadou privately.
"You have to tell Issa the truth. Leaving him in the dark like this isn't fair. It might put him in greater danger, and you know he's already been hurt."
"He's going to think I'm involved."
"He's the one who insisted on your release. He wouldn't have done it if he thought you were involved."
Amadou shrugged his powerful shoulders, the movement so effortlessly graceful that Aliza wished she were like her sister Nazneen, the artist, who would have captured the gesture on canvas. But she was more like her sister Miraj, doggedly after the truth. Something was going to happen at the vigil tonight. That's why she needed to be there.
"What happened at the mosque has nothing to do with Michel Gagnon or his flunkies."
"Or your brother?" she asked Amadou softly.
Amadou blinked to hide the moisture that sheened his eyes.
"Bilal is gone. It's time to let him rest in peace."
Aliza's white teeth bit at her lower lip. There was something she needed to say to Amadou. He and Yusuf had been her steadfast partners in the battle against the insidious poison seeping through the veins of Saint Isidore, but she was afraid that putting it into words might make Amadou think she blamed him when she didn't. No matter how carefully she said it, she could still see it going wrong.
"Spit it out, Aliza. Tell me. You can tell me anything, even about Maxime."
He shrugged again.
"If you want him, we'll find a way to get him on our side."
Startled, her eyes flew to his.
"I don't want him. Why would you say such a thing?"
When Amadou wisely didn't speak, she knew he was thinking of the photograph she hated, the one where she'd taken Maxime's face in her hands.
Anyone looking at it would draw the wrong conclusions, including Issa. But Issa had seen their interaction firsthand. Surely he wouldn't think she'd set aside everything she believed in for someone like Max. Or maybe, she thought wryly, she was protesting too much. Amadou's voice boomed in her ear.
If it's not about Max, then what? Whatever you want to say, say it to me, Aliza.
Their eyes met and held, eloquent with fear. At last, Aliza exhaled on a sigh, her arms clasped to her middle, as if still in the posture of prayer.
I just wanted you to know that you didn't bring this madness to Saint Isidore. You didn't kill Yusuf, and you aren't responsible for what happened at the mosque.
Amadou's shoulders sagged.
So you do think it was a hit?
They'd kept a close watch on Wolf Allegiance's online chatter and on other online platforms. The comments after the prayer at the church had terrified them both.
I don't know what I think it was. Gagnon's men, Max's followers, or maybe Maxime himself. I don't know. I just keep thinking.
Her voice trailed off.
What? Tell me, he said again.
I keep thinking about that woman in the abaya, the one caught on camera. Who was she? Why did she have a gun?
She glanced around the garden, her gaze moving from face to face.
It couldn't have been one of us. It doesn't make any sense. Then why was she wearing an abaya?
If you dive into the abyss, go all the way to the bottom.
Her heart skipped a beat. She was afraid to ask Amadou the meaning of his words, and unconsciously she cast a yearning glance at Issa. His clear, green gaze was focused on her, solicitous and intent. She wanted to speak to him, to go to him, but she was afraid of what he might say.
Amadou tugged at her arm. By wearing the abaya and getting caught on camera, the shooter succeeded at the most important thing.
She looked back at him. In a whisper, she asked him what he meant, but she should have known the answer.
He put the blame for our tragedy on us.
Issa was quiet at Aliza's side as they followed Amadou across the stone bridge to a path that led deep into the woods. At the bridge, there were views of the mosque, the church, and the university on the hill. Some 40 minutes later, as they headed west of the town, they were surrounded by trees in the thickly forested wood, their path shadowed by the murmur of water. The officers whose presence Issa had requested were waiting at the edge of the clearing they approached.
Where's Rachel?
Aliza asked, feeling her absence. Issa looked at her briefly, and she felt herself floundering, though she kept her face composed.
With Seher.
So he'd sent Rachel to Seher, but was here with her himself. She hugged his concern to herself, refusing to admit what it meant to her. The rain had cleared away the humidity, and the night air was crisper than it had been in the Soufiane's garden. She'd worn a long-sleeved sweater, knowing the night would grow cool. She'd been to the Lilies' meeting place before, both as a matter of personal curiosity and in the process of coming to understand them. The meeting place was a thickly forested spot deep in the heart of the woods, where a secret pond, much smaller than the lake, was set in a circle of trees. An hour's walk east would see them back in the center of town, but at the moment, it seemed as though they'd stepped through a portal to a quiet, unfamiliar world. Émilie and Réjeanne had often discussed the sacred nature of circles, and Aliza had sometimes tagged along. She knew there was more to it, though. The Lilies were rebels, outsiders who'd been scorned for their ties to the Muslim community. The woods made them feel safe, special, a place where no one intruded, where they were free to be themselves. to explore what they called the feminine in nature. But Eliza had also accompanied them so she could keep an eye on Chloe, who was younger and more passive than her friends. Her views were often swept aside by the other girls' stronger personalities. So watching out for Chloe was Eliza's gift to her friend Yusuf, the one person who'd been able to reach the fragile girl inside. Chloe had blossomed under his attention, and Eliza was uncomfortably reminded of the letters she herself had written to Issa. In the center of the small lake, some 20 feet from the shore, a miniature dock was anchored to the bottom by a set of posts, one of which supported a bird feeder with a slate-gray roof. Eliza drew in a breath, savoring the bite of the pines and the smell of rain-washed earth. The path was littered with small stones, and little pebbles found their way into her shoes. She'd wound her shawl around her torso to keep warm, and whimsically, she imagined herself as a bluebird guiding others into the woods. When they were all assembled at a little clearing by the lake, Réjeanne intoned a strange set of words in French, rustic, arcane, empty of meaning. As she spoke, she sketched an incantation in the air. Eliza stole a glance at Khattak, wondering what he made of Réjeanne's actions. His expression was impassive, even faintly bored. Réjeanne had dropped her knapsack on the ground, and now she opened it, taking out her phone and setting it on a rock. She hit a button, and an intricate little melody drifted over their heads. Next, she produced a miniature leather-wrapped bundle and lit a match to a fragrant pouch of herbs. Émilie took Chloe by the hand and pushed her into the center of the clearing. Réjeanne circled Chloe, holding a bundle of sage aloft in her hands. Its smoky, sweet scent made Eliza cough. As Réjeanne continued to circle Chloe, she recited a kind of eulogy. She spoke of Youssef Soufiane and of other victims of the mosque shooting the Lilies of Anjou had known. While she spoke, Émilie knelt on the ground beside her knapsack, taking out a set of lanterns painted a faded gold. She lit the lanterns with matches from a little matchbook. The matchbook was from the cafe near campus where Eliza had taken Issa and Rachel. A rustling sounded from somewhere behind them, and Eliza turned to look. Issa nodded to the officers on the perimeter, who swept their flashlights back over the path they'd traveled to the lake. Nothing moved in the dark. There were only the sounds of the forest. The wind brushing lightly over the maples, small creatures scurrying swiftly over ground, the slow, warm benevolence of the lulling motion of the waves. Issa switched his flashlight off, observing the trio of lilies perform their dance to the music from Réjeanne's phone. Their flowing skirts trailed behind them as they danced. Though they performed the dance with quiet concentration, Eliza sensed that something was off. The scent of sage turned acrid as it burned. Without having moved, she found herself between Amadou and Issa, shielded from unknown danger. Émilie's concentration was broken. She scowled over at Amadou, whose body sheltered Eliza. As the music wound down, Réjeanne intoned, "Let the lanterns of death carry your grief away. It's time, Chloe, time to mourn Youssef and let him go." She wheeled suddenly, her arm falling in a graceful arc, and whispered straight at Khattak, "Let your husband go." The other girls went still. Somewhere over the lake, the cry of a loon punctured the darkness. Émilie began to push the floating lanterns out toward the mooring post in the water. She'd lit the candles inside, and now, in the immutable darkness of the woods, the candles glimmered like fireflies bobbing above the waves. Chloe tugged the long sleeves of her dress all the way over her hands. Then she put up her hands to her face and began to cry, not daintily as she'd done before, the tips of her ears and her nose red, but with harsh, convulsive sobs that shook her fragile frame. Rejane abandoned her act and snatched Chloe up in her arms.
"Shh, shh, it's all right. You can tell them about Youssef, Chloe. It's time to tell them the truth."
Chapter 62. Issa's gaze tangled with Aliza's. He looked over her head back at the way they'd come, thinking of how Lumiere had refused to assign an officer to Seher for protection. He needed Rachel here. This was the kind of thing she excelled at. She had already established a bond with Chloe. As the girl began to calm in Rejane's arms, Issa asked Rejane,
"They were married."
Chloe's sobs had turned into hiccups. Rejane rubbed her back in a circular motion.
"Right here in this clearing," she said. "We served as witnesses. Youssef's mother was here too."
Issa's eyes squinted against the darkness, trying to see Chloe's face without the use of the flashlight.
"Who officiated the ceremony?"
"I'm surprised you don't know. It was Père Etienne."
Rejane's statement carried the weight of a confession, but Aliza couldn't make out its import. She looked at Issa again, observing the tension in his face. The confession meant something to Issa that she hadn't grasped. After a pause, he asked,
"A Catholic ceremony?"
Rejane nodded. Issa gestured at the clearing.
"With a similar set of rituals, the dance, and so on?"
Rejane smirked.
"Not in front of Père Etienne. He would have accused us of witchcraft."
"I'm surprised he was willing to venture outside of the church. He couldn't have thought it proper."
Now he addressed Chloe, his voice grave and deep.
"Did Youssef become a Catholic?"
Chloe raised her ravaged face to his, her body propped up by Rejane.
"His mother said he could, so he did."
But something in her face gave her away.
"It wasn't real," Issa guessed. "It was a means to an end, the end being that he wanted to be able to claim you as his own."
"Yes."
Her voice came out in a whisper.
"We belonged to each other."
From the corner of his eye, he saw Amadou move away to the edge of the water where Emily was still setting the lanterns adrift.
"You didn't tell us that before."
He gentled his voice, speaking to her the way he would to calm a frightened child.
"Chloe, can you tell me anything about the lily that was carved on Youssef's back? Did that have something to do with you, or with the lilies of Anjou?"
She shook her head, the frantic motion sending her long, pale hair flying about her face.
"No, no, never. I would never have done that to Youssef, and especially because—"
Suddenly bored, Rejane released her hold on Chloe and stalked away to join Amadou. There was a small smile playing about her lips that reminded Issa that she'd said he would find what he'd been searching for in the woods.
"Because?"
Issa prompted. Chloe held up her arm and pulled back her long sleeve. She turned her wrist outward to show him the delicate tattoo.
"Youssef didn't like my tattoo. He asked me to get it removed, but my family said that I shouldn't."
Khatak's gaze flicked to Aliza, who he knew would understand. Many Muslims believed that the body should be returned to God without altering his creation. A permanent mark such as a tattoo was at odds with that belief. But why did any of it matter?
"Did Rejane and Emily know? Did anyone object to you having the tattoo removed? Were you planning to get rid of it?"
Chloe's hiccups had subsided, and now she was able to speak clearly.
"I would have done anything for Youssef, but we weren't even married a week. I didn't have time to do as he'd asked me.
I told Rejan, but she was the only one.
Another dead end. He thanked Chloe for telling him. After a moment's consideration, he asked Rejan to join him at the edge of the lake, where he pressed her for the rest. She didn't answer his question about the tattoo, though there was a stillness about her, as though she was expecting something else from him. The clever little smirk was still on her lips.
Rejan, his voice darkened with caution. If you know something, a murder investigation is a dangerous place to keep secrets.
She stretched, letting her sleeves fall back along her strong white arms.
I'm not keeping secrets. I brought you here to reveal them.
Her gaze drifted over the lake. She pointed to something in the distance. He switched on his flashlight again. It lanced across the water, tracking the path of the lanterns. Two of the lanterns had bumped up against the dock and stopped there. He swept his flashlight across the lake twice before he saw it. Then he called in the officers who'd stood back observing the scene. Someone had drawn an arrow pointing up to the bird feeder on the post that faced the shore. Something dark was wedged into the opening of the feeder. He trained the flashlight on the bird feeder's mouth. It took his mind a moment to sort out what he was seeing. Amadou saw it first. He looked back at Chloe and Aliza and said,
"There's a gun out there on the lake."
Chapter 63. Though she was tall, Rachel had to jog to keep up with Lemaire's brisk pace. He was calling team members in from each of the inner offices. She'd left Seher with Dr. Sandston, and a sternly worded warning not to wander off on her own, offering Seher the tried and true, "If anything happens to you, the boss will never forgive me." In the center of the large room, team members gathered, ready to report on progress. Dr. Agarwal was back with another update on the series of autopsies her team had performed. She had no further forensic evidence to share, but she gave the go-ahead for funerals to proceed. Lemaire nodded. His blue eyes swept the room, a blue that reminded Rachel of the pieces of Caithness glass she'd used to decorate her condo. She noticed something else, too. Roughly a third of the team members were missing. Lemaire barked out orders at the others. They hustled to the small armory at the back to don protective gear. Everyone seemed to be in on a secret that Rachel didn't know. Except for Gaffney and Benoit, both crouched in front of their computers, stabbing away at something Rachel couldn't see. Gaff nodded at Lemaire.
"We're good to go." "You'll need a vest," Lemaire told her.
"We're going out on a raid?" She followed him to the armory, her mind full of questions. Lemaire had told her about infiltration. He hadn't told her that he was prepared to act. But all those sidebars, those team meetings, when she'd thought he'd been instructing his team on the investigation into the shooting, this was what he'd been doing, setting up the takedown to pull in members of law enforcement suspected of working with the Allegiance by catching them in the act, proof of which must have been established while she'd been busy with the shooting. She shouldered into her vest, watching as he did the same.
"I'm surprised they found one to fit you."
His dancing blue eyes found hers.
"They could have asked you," he told her. "You've been tracking me pretty good."
Rachel's thoughts shorted out, a hot red stain climbing her face. Before she could stammer a reply, he went on,
"Just like I've been tracking you."
Rachel blinked several times, but Lemaire didn't drop his gaze. It was rock steady holding hers. Finally, she said,
"You're an excellent cop."
"Yeah?"
It came out like a lazy drawl. He tossed her a helmet with a black visor and took another for himself.
"So are you. Is that all it is?"
Her fingers clutched the helmet helplessly. Lemaire's unequivocal expression of his interest floored her. He came closer, helping her fasten her vest. Rachel's breath hitched in her chest. He was so close, so big that he surrounded her, like the men she sometimes played hockey with. He smelled like summer wind and fresh pine, tall and strong as an oak. He used the vest to tug her a little closer, his teasing softening at her obvious bewilderment.
"I'm your senior officer. As long as we're working together, nothing can happen here."
He fastened the vest and let go.
"But you should know I want it to, after this is over."
Rachel needed a moment to collect her thoughts. For whatever inexplicable reason, this roughly attractive man was expressing his interest in her. But there was none of the queasiness or helpless rage she'd felt with her former boss. He'd stepped away, giving her space if she wanted it. But space wasn't what she needed. She was imagining Lemaire pulling her close with that same lazy smile and tugging her into his arms. She wanted to get close. She wanted to be close.
"Ready, sir."
Another officer interrupted them. Rachel watched Lemaire reel off a list of instructions. She could have slipped out of the armory and left them to it. She could have turned tail and run. Instead, she waited for Lemaire to finish. He was nearly ready to head out. He cocked his head at her and waited. She stepped into his space, reaching around him to fasten his vest, letting her hands linger on his chest.
"You're not anything like him, and I want it to happen too."
Now the blue eyes blazed at her, and the cocky grin disappeared. He gave her a short, brisk nod.
"Good," he said gruffly. "Then let's get this done."
Gaff caught her on the way down the steps.
"What is it?"
She lifted the visor to look at him, and then remembered to ask him to keep a close watch on Seher.
"Where's Hatak?"
he added.
"Still at the vigil, why?"
"Benoit and I tracked down each member of this team, nearly all seconded from the Sûreté du Québec, with white supremacist ties."
Lemaire looked up at them from the bottom of the steps, and he hesitated.
"There are some anomalies. I'd prefer it if Hatak had your back."
"What kind of anomalies?"
"Rachel!"
Lemaire called her to come. It wasn't a request.
"I haven't figured it out," Gaff muttered. "But something's off around here, even about this sting."
He drew her aside so Lemaire couldn't overhear.
"I've seen the way Lemaire looks at you, but maybe he's trying to distract you from something else."
Rachel's face was white under her helmet. She climbed into the van. The driver shifted smoothly onto the main road, and Rachel tried to get her bearings as they drove past the station and around the bend of the creek. For a moment, she could glimpse some of the town's landmarks from the center, the university, the town hall, and the church. Lemaire had insisted that she take the seat across from him. Swallowing hard, she'd listened. She couldn't be wrong about him, she told herself. It couldn't be an act. What would be the point? But a cold, analytical part of her brain provided the answer at once.
"To draw you away from the Wolf Allegiance, to disguise the extent of their infiltration into the Sûreté and our inset team."
And what better way to distract her than to pretend an interest? He was the one who'd repeatedly asked her to partner with him, leaving Hatak on his own, an act that served a twofold purpose. Neither one of them had backup, and neither one had the chance to get inside Lemaire's operation. And the worst part was that it was entirely consistent with Lemaire's actions from the outset of the operation. The arrest of Amadou Duchamp, the free hand Lemaire had given Thibault and his thugs, his lack of response to Elisa's list of hate crimes, the way he'd failed to dig out Pascal Richard's ties to neo-Nazis, right down to not noticing the swastika at the back of Richard's head. his failure to offer protection to Eliza and Amadou or to put a watch on the mosque. He'd taken no action on a profiler or on following up on who might have been responsible for the assault on Khattak. In fact, he'd dared to suggest that Khattak had contrived the entire incident to focus the investigation where he wanted it, squarely on the allegiance and their ilk. Something niggled at her memory, some small, insignificant detail. There was something Lemaire had dismissed. It slipped through her mind, elusive and dark. She listened to Lemaire go over the raid with the tactical team commander in his strong, dark tones and forced herself to think. It had happened almost at the beginning. It was almost the first thing Khattak had singled out.
What was it?
The van hurtled around the corner past the empty parking lot of the mosque. Someone had made an attempt to wash out the spray-painted swastika, covering it with patterns in green. Abruptly, Rachel remembered.
The synagogue was vandalized first.
And Lemaire had done nothing in response. Not even when Khattak had warned him to make the synagogue a priority. Her hands shook in her lap, her fingertips ice cold. These were things he would have done, not to entrap others, but because he himself was behind them. The photograph on the wall in his office lurched up in her memory. He'd given a neo-Nazi the key to Saint Isidore. Wasn't that proof of his corruption? What greater proof did she need? She'd been disarmed from the first by Superintendent Killiam's recommendation of Lemaire, and then by the personal interest he'd used every opportunity to express. If he'd been conducting a sting, he would have wanted to lock things down and keep them quiet. Instead, he'd invited her in, and he'd given Khattak and Gaffney a free hand. She sucked in her lips in a bitter grimace, tears forming in her eyes behind the visor. They were tears of humiliation. Because, of course, she'd fallen for it, for him. She'd stupidly imagined that a man like Lemaire might actually be interested in her. And then, she was struck by a far more terrible thought. Sick to her stomach, Rachel began to sweat. She had only Lemaire's word for it that he'd seen someone push her from the bench in the church. She'd heard only one set of footsteps approach. What if Lemaire himself had pushed her from the bench? He'd struck his head because he hadn't been able to move out of the way in time, and then he'd used her ensuing concern to his benefit, seeing at once the ways in which she could be manipulated. He must have known about her father. As a police officer, he'd be familiar with the profile, with her vulnerabilities. She'd always have the need to prove herself to a man in a position of authority. He'd used that. Used her. A furious rage replaced her self-pity. Lemaire had wanted her here in this van. She didn't need to be here. She should have been with Khattak. He looked up at her and smiled. She sketched a stiff smile in return, a painful movement of air between her lips. Like a death rattle, she thought. He must have seen it too, because he asked, "Are you all right?" She took too long to answer. He leaned across the open space, whispering, "Don't be afraid, Rachel. I'm going to take care of you." Chapter 64. It had taken some time to retrieve the gun. A call out to Gaffney to mobilize resources while keeping things quiet enough to prevent a leak had resulted in Benoit showing up to fetch it with the appropriate gear. Now Khattak entered the gun into evidence, frowning at the empty station. He'd insisted that Eliza and Amadou accompany him. He left them waiting in the lounge. Gaffney found him a few minutes later and brought him up to date. Grimly, Khattak said, "Our communication with Lemaire seems to be a one-way street." When Gaffney told him the rest, his response was so fierce that it brought Seher out of Dr. Sandston's office. What's happened? Nothing, he said, trying to soften his voice, aggrieved at the sight of her in the center of a perilous storm. He had to get her out of the station so he could focus. But the warning Dr. Sandston had given him was too serious to ignore. She had suggested that his stalker had targeted others connected to him in the past. If Tom Paley hadn't died of an innocuous heart attack, if his death had been part of some twisted campaign against Khattak, that meant he wasn't dealing with a stalker. Khattak was dealing with a killer.
Something, Seher persisted. Tell me so I can help.
He throttled the angry words that rose to his lips. He tugged her out into the lobby, his hand on her wrist, possessive, thrilled by the answering flame in her eyes, until he realized that it was anger, anger in place of passion. He'd worked too hard to arrive at this place with Seher. If he went on as he had in the past, as he had with his sisters, ruthlessly overprotective, he might end up losing what he'd worked for, as he had with Ruksh. He expelled a harsh breath. If he was going to do this, he wouldn't hold anything back. Rachel is out on a raid with Lemaire. He hasn't kept me informed, and I'm concerned that there's a reason for that, that he's put her in danger on purpose. And with the photographs and the messages and the attack... His expression was so fierce that she grimaced. God help me, Seher, having you here, defenseless and at risk, is preventing me from doing my job. I can't focus when you're in the way, but I don't want you anywhere else. She studied his face in silence, drawing it out so he had time to get himself under control and think back over what he'd said. A flash of alarm passed through his eyes.
Seher.
In the clear, precise tones of a prosecutor, she said,
What makes you think I'm defenseless? Do you think I just wandered into the midst of a refugee crisis without taking any steps to prepare myself, to protect myself?
She was using the same tone she used when she conducted a cross-examination. Angrily, he said,
I was taken by surprise, and I'm a police officer. Forgive me for thinking that you might be more vulnerable than I am.
Her reply was measured.
It's because I'm a woman that I take sensible precautions. For example, Inspector Khattak, I would not have attempted a rendezvous with my partner at an unknown location without calling to check with her first. I would not have entered an abandoned building on my own in the middle of the night. I would have called for backup and waited. So you tell me, Issa Khattak, which one of us is more reckless when it comes to taking risks?
He stood in front of her, speechless, and she smiled. She reached up to stroke his forehead where the bruise had grown more noticeable. Gently, she said,
You're allowed to worry, but I'm not. Do you think it's been easy for me so far away from you in Greece? Seher.
Her arms circled his neck.
Now is when you kiss me.
He didn't need to be told twice. When at last she broke away, her mouth was full and throbbing. His lips strayed over her temples, pressing kisses into her hair.
It's stopping that's the hard part, he said. Once you let me start.
She pressed herself closer, and he relished the weight of her in his arms, soft and supple and strong. This time she kissed him, her hand reaching up to stroke his jaw.
Keep the beard, she teased. It has definite possibilities.
When she saw the surprise on his face, she asked,
Was that too much?
He recovered himself at once.
It's never too much, Seher. If anything, it's not enough.
With a deepening of his voice, he said, Does this change things? Do you want a traditional wedding? full of fanfare, laughter, music, and food, the kind of wedding he'd had with Samina years ago. Seher was watching his face. The rueful smile that touched her lips turned his heart over. 3 to 6 functions taking us months to arrange. The teasing look was back in her eyes. You haven't asked me properly yet. And he damned well wasn't going to in the middle of a police station. Oh, I'll ask you. I was just hoping for a concession. Her expression became serious. To stop her from saying something he knew would hurt, he kissed her again, pushing past the boundaries he knew she was trying to observe. But he'd mistaken her. Her hands tangled in his hair. She gave in to the kiss wholeheartedly. I don't want any of that, she muttered against his mouth. I don't need it. I don't even need the ring. I just want you, Issa. I've waited a long time. I don't want to wait any longer. She was breathing harshly against his lips, driven as much by anguish as by love. Gaffney stepped into the lobby. I've got Superintendent Killiam on the line. Khattak squeezed Seher's hand and let her go. His conversation with Killiam was brief and to the point. The only progress he could report was that they thought they had found the gun. Benoit was processing the details. But when he shared his suspicions about Christian Lemaire, Killiam asked him bluntly, Has he treated you badly? Issa frowned. His experience with Lemaire had no bearing on the suspicions he'd just raised. If he was honest with himself, stopping himself making things personal was also the only way he was able to focus on his job. He's kept me out of the loop. Killiam disagreed. He's kept you informed through Rachel and left you to do the work you were sent to Saint Isidore to do. Have some faith in your partner. She's an excellent judge of character. Killiam ended the call. Khattak strode to the armory, calling Gaffney to join him. Just a moment, sir. Benoit waved him over to his desk. The gun you brought in? The ballistics were a match to the handgun used in the executions. It was a legally registered firearm. It wasn't connected to Gagnon or any of the biker gangs. Khattak doubled back. But it doesn't make any sense. Reading the name over his shoulder, Khattak felt as though he'd stepped into quicksand, because the gun involved in the shooting was registered to Youssef Soufiane. Chapter 65. The raid on the Wolf Allegiance's headquarters went down exactly as Lemaire claimed to have planned, designed to entrap police officers who'd been working with the Allegiance to stir up trouble in Saint Isidore and to subvert the investigation into the shooting at the mosque. He'd divided the targets into 3 groups, assigning his hand-picked team into the mix alongside officers seconded to Inset. Now the tactical team reported in from the other 2 locations. They had the arrests in hand. They'd taken their targets by surprise. Lemaire's team acted last. His presence in the center of the operation gave them a tactical advantage. He leapt out from the back of the van, summoning Rachel to follow. She made herself count her breaths, trying to hold on to her nerve. When she stepped out of the van, she recognized the location. It was the same building where she'd picked up Khattak after the attack. She saw the sign he'd mentioned before listing in the wind. The target location was the same place where Khattak had been assaulted and nearly choked to death. She tipped her visor up slightly for a better look at Lemaire's face. What kind of game was he playing? What was waiting for her inside? Lemaire snapped his fingers and the team divided in 2. Now, in the warm silence of the summer night, Rachel followed his lead. There were 6 other officers with them. 4 went ahead, circling around the back. Lemaire kept her behind him and signaled the other 2. In a minute, the door was breached. Go, Lemaire shouted. He drew his weapon. Rachel followed at his heels, her hand feeling for the reassuring weight of her gun. Inside, the scene was chaotic. Men crashed through the back entrance. Everyone ran. Tall, broad-shouldered men with brush cuts threw down chairs. Rachel stumbled over a chair, her leg getting trapped inside it. Someone aimed a fist at her head, and she ducked, flattening her shoulders so the man went sailing past her. There were candles lit against one wall. As she fell, she saw the image of a wolf's head on the wall. Someone kicked at her, a heavy boot against her ribs. She swiftly rolled to one side, scrambling back to her feet. A shot was fired from the outer room, and she whirled to face the sound. Whatever Lemaire had planned, he'd underestimated the number of men he needed. At least one of the men inside had escaped, and two other officers were down. Someone had lit a smoke bomb. Coughing, Rachel pulled the visor closer to her head. She scrabbled over to check on a man on the floor. He was bleeding from a blow to the head. One of the members of the Wolf Allegiance dived in her direction, her heart thudding in her chest. She waited. When his arm came down on her throat, she slammed her fist into his ribs. He was tackled by an inset team member and forced down onto his knees. Rachel grabbed the injured cop on the floor and dragged him off to one side. A foot kicked out and connected with her visor. Stunned by the blow, she fell back. When nothing else followed, she ripped the helmet from her head. Her visor had been smashed, and now she couldn't see through it, though it would have been safer to keep it on. Staying low to the floor, she searched for an opening, for an opponent she could take down. There was a gunshot, followed by another. Most of the men in the room had been subdued, members of the Allegiance, but also a few officers Rachel recognized from the first team briefing. But Lemaire wasn't in the room. She wiped the sweat from her eyes, pushing back sticky strands of hair. She dried her palms on her slacks, then reached down for her gun. Her hand closed on empty space. She'd lost the gun in the fight. She took hold of her baton instead, hearing the sounds of a struggle somewhere deeper inside the building. She pushed through the smoke, blindly following the sound. She called out a warning in her strongest voice. No one responded, so she stole along a corridor to a passageway at the end. The smoke thinned out as she moved, too late to stop her from tripping on a piece of rebar and crashing through the room beyond. She fell awkwardly on her wrist. Her baton rolled out of her reach. Blinking through the dust, she saw that it had come to rest against a man's black shoes. Awkwardly, she stumbled to her feet. She was alone in the room with Lemaire, and his gun was pointed at her head. The blood rushed from her head. She held up her hands in surrender. His burning eyes locked on hers. "Don't move another step." A whimper escaped her lips. She took a trembling step back. "I said don't move."
"Please." Her aching whisper hurt her throat. "I'm asking you not to shoot."
His gaze flicked over her shoulder and back to her sweating face. Terror colored her vision, the scent of it acrid and hopeless. She was out of moves. She couldn't stop him, and she knew from the lethal purpose in his eyes that he wasn't going to change his mind. Then, a tiny corner of her mind registered the sound of movement, the harsh breath of another person at her ear, someone close enough to save her. She made a life-or-death decision and fainted back. Lemaire aimed his gun and fired. Rachel was on the floor, gasping. She felt a heavy weight collapse over her chest. Blood began to ooze from her neck. She thought she'd screamed, but the sound came out as a croak. Her whole body was on fire, her chest convulsed in reaction, her ears ringing from the gunshot. She was breathing in dust and debris, choking on the smoke in her mouth. The weight on her chest grew heavier, the blood sliding down her neck under her clothing, pooling between her breasts. Her hands scrabbled to touch the wound, but they were weighted down as well. She couldn't breathe. She was suffocating in her own blood. Then the weight on her chest shifted. What had felt like a drowning embrace was lifted from the floor and shoved aside. Lemaire straddled her body and pushed her down. He'd taken off his helmet and gloves. His hands made a thorough search. They came away red with blood.
"Christ, woman, I told you not to move!"
He shouted something into the other room, stripping the vest from her body with hands that shook. She was drowning in sweat and blood, but still she tried to call for help. Lemaire shifted aside and pulled her up in his arms. He braced her against one knee, pressing his glove to the wound at her neck. His free hand brushed the hair from her face, and then there were others in the room, paramedics who laid her down again and switched her over to a stretcher. The room was suddenly filled with blinding light. She felt the sting of anesthetic at her neck, dizziness darkening her thoughts. She heard someone say, "Missed the artery. Did you get him?" and saw Lemaire nod once. Through a haze of smoke and dust, she struggled to make sense of the chaos in the room. Her chest was no longer aching. Lemaire had stripped off her shirt as well as her vest, and when she looked down at her torso, she couldn't see a bullet wound. Her fingers traced over her ribs and sternum. There was a biting sting at her neck, but she seemed otherwise unharmed. Her gaze followed the movement of the paramedics. They were lifting another body onto a second stretcher. He was dressed like a member of the Allegiance. A paramedic stopped to kick away the gun still clenched in his hand. It was taken into evidence by another officer.
"Still smoking," the officer said. "I don't know how he missed," Lemaire answered. "She stumbled right into his path."
Rachel raised her eyes to his face and saw that he'd lost his normal, healthy color.
"Why didn't you listen? I told you I had it covered."
She was shivering violently, trying to make sense of the sequence of events. The heavy weight that had trapped her body, that sense that she'd been on fire. Lemaire snapped at someone behind her. Her half-naked body was wrapped in a cotton blanket. "It doesn't need stitches," the paramedic told her. He'd cleaned the wound from the bullet that had grazed her and set a thick bandage in place.
"Doesn't mean it won't hurt like hell."
Rachel nodded absently, her gaze still fixed on Lemaire.
"Christ, woman," he repeated. "You just took years off my life. Is this what you do to Hattak? No wonder the man's on edge."
The words sounded fuzzy in her ears. She jerked her chin at the dead man on the stretcher.
"He's the one who shot me?"
Lemaire's head came up with a jerk. His hot blue gaze found hers.
"What the hell did you say?"
The minute he said it, Rachel knew. She had no answer for his outrage. He spoke to her slowly, measuring out each word.
"You thought I was aiming at you."
"Please,"
Rachel choked back a sob.
"Christian, I'm sorry. I lost my bearings in the smoke."
He knew it was more than that. Hostility darkened his face. He leaned down, putting his face close to hers, his blue eyes bleak with regret.
"I was wrong about you, Sergeant Getty. You were never a member of my team."
Chapter 66. 3 days passed before Rachel was able to insist on being discharged. Issa was at her bedside, where she was grumpily listening to the doctor, who'd seen too many of the dead to give in to Rachel's demands.
"I'll certify you unfit for duty if you keep putting up a fuss."
"That's blackmail,"
Rachel grumbled.
"Well," the doctor hooked a clipboard over her arm, "blackmail would be the least offensive thing to have happened in Saint Isidore for months."
"She'll stay," Hattak told the doctor firmly, "until you say she can go." The doctor's eyes ran over the bruises on his face and neck.
You're not looking too good either.
Ha, Rachel said. That's got to be the first time someone said that to you.
The doctor hid a smile at Khattak's embarrassment.
I'll work up your papers, she promised Rachel.
Rachel studied the bruise on Khattak's forehead.
We're quite a pair, aren't we?
He tried not to grin and failed. Decorated officers.
What made Gaff suspicious of Lemaire? I screwed up there. He's not going to want to work with me again.
She didn't need to state aloud that she'd repaid Lemaire's trust with unstinting disloyalty.
Oh, I think he will,
Khattak told her, nodding at the door. Rachel's temperature shot up. With everything that was going on at the station, Lemaire couldn't be at her door. All hands were needed on deck.
He's asked the nurse about you at least a dozen times over the last few days. He's waiting for me to leave.
You probably shouldn't, Rachel said. He might throttle me in my bed.
He'd avoided answering her question about Lemaire, so doggedly she asked it again. Gaffney's leads point to a senior figure as the leak. That's why the raid went south. The officers recruited to the Allegiance had a few minutes' warning of the raid. Gaff thought the leak might be Lemaire because Lemaire didn't take anyone into his confidence, but we know now he was right to keep what he knew to himself.
Where is Gaff now?
With Seher.
He didn't have to tell her that he didn't trust any of Lemaire's officers with Seher's safety. There might be others associated with the Allegiance who had escaped the raid.
And the kids?
Outside, waiting for me. Aliza wants to see you, and we need to talk to Chloe.
He looked a little discomfited as he asked, Now that you're back on your feet, could you be the one to speak to her?
Why me, especially? You usually have more luck with women.
He told her what they'd learned about Yusuf's gun, that it was the weapon that had been used to murder the women in the basement of the mosque, and Chloe had to know something about the gun.
You made a connection with her. You'll be able to draw her out.
He hesitated as if he would say more, and Rachel suddenly had an inkling of what might be in his mind. Her brother, Zach, and her work with troubled youth. She quickly straightened up.
Let's get me discharged. Lemaire's operation may have been a success in terms of rooting out white supremacists in law enforcement, but we still haven't caught the shooter at the mosque.
Feeling like a new woman after a brisk shower in the washroom attached to her hospital room, Rachel mumbled a question at Aliza as she pulled a fresh shirt over her head.
Yusuf was a good friend of yours. Do you know why he had a gun?
With a curious note of detachment in her voice, Aliza asked,
Rachel, weren't you paying attention to the list of incidents I gave you? We reported them to the dean. We also reported the break-in, but the administration took no action. We also informed the police about the vandalism of the mosque and synagogue, but again, no one took any action.
Drawing her jacket back on, Rachel holstered her gun at her waist. Lemaire had found it for her and placed it in her hands with that still banked fury in his eyes. She'd have to work up the nerve to deal with him once they'd run the killer to ground. They were close to untangling this whole mess. She gave Aliza a summary of Lemaire's operation, watching the girl tilt up her head. Aliza shivered in relief.
I wish Inspector Lemaire had told me what he was doing, she said. All this time, I didn't think anyone cared.
She handed Rachel her jacket and helped her shrug it on.
When no one was willing to respond to our complaints, we felt endangered, and that's why Yusuf got the gun. The threats against Yusuf and Amadou were becoming serious because of their involvement with Chloe and Emily.
Aliza abruptly went still. She turned to look at Rachel, the words falling slowly, sounding like they'd come from a great distance away.
Why are you asking me about Yusef's gun?
From the wary look in her eyes, Aliza had already begun to suspect.
The gun we recovered from the lake was registered to Yusef. You didn't recognize it?
Aliza shook her head, her eyes deeply shadowed.
I'd never seen it. I didn't even know what kind of gun it was.
Rachel could see that she was trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, but finding it impossible to do so.
This can't leave the room, Aliza. The gun used in the basement executions turned out to be Yusef's gun.
Aliza took a faltering step back. She came up against Rachel's hospital bed and sank down in the chair across from it. She bent over her knees and put her head in her hands, speaking to herself.
Didn't anyone read that list?
Rachel squatted down on her knees in front of Aliza, wincing as the movement pulled at the bandage at her neck.
What do you know that I don't?
Aliza's head came up, her green eyes filled with fury.
I gave you the list, Rachel. I put it in your hands myself. You took it to the dean.
Instantly, Rachel understood.
The campus break-in? The gun was taken from your office along with the electronics you had reported stolen. That's where Yusef kept it.
But Rachel's memory was excellent. While the break-in at the office had been reported, the stolen gun was absent from Aliza's complaint. Aliza rubbed at her eyes.
I reported everything except the gun because I didn't want to get Yusef in trouble. But all this time you knew the gun was out there? You blamed the Wolf Allegiance for the break-in, but you never thought to tell us they might have Yusef's gun?
But Aliza didn't need her rebuke. She was already blaming herself.
The news only reported that Père Etienne had been found with an assault rifle. They didn't mention another gun, neither did you.
But surely to God, if you thought there was a gun in their possession, you should have reported it to us.
I know, she whispered. There was so much going on, I didn't have time to tell you.
Rachel was watching Aliza closely. Something didn't add up. She'd never known Aliza to be anything other than forthright, but something in her face had shut down.
Maybe you didn't think a member of the Allegiance took it. Maybe you had a reason to think someone you knew might have needed that gun. Maybe it was the Lilies of Anjou as part of their rituals in the forest. Maybe that's how they knew where the gun was.
She caught the subtle shift of Aliza's glance.
No? Who then?
But she only had to think of the person Aliza had been inseparable from since Rachel and Issa had arrived in Saint Isidore. Aliza was trying to protect Amadou Duchamp. Aliza pushed herself out of the chair and sidestepped Rachel.
I swear to you, Amadou wasn't the shooter at the mosque.
He was there that night.
To pray. Yusef was like a brother to him. He tried to save his life.
Amadou had a brother, Rachel said. Aliza's face was pale, her skin clammy, but she didn't say anything more. A heavy hand knocked on the door. Lemaire stepped into the small room, instantly making it smaller. His gaze slid from Rachel to Aliza.
What's happened?
Nothing.
Aliza's voice broke. She whirled on her heel and left the room, leaving Lemaire with Rachel. He looked her over, his gaze lingering on the bandage at her neck. Frowning a little, he said,
Should you be up and about?
I'm headed back to work.
The silence between them built until Rachel finally cleared her throat and spoke.
Listen, Christian, I'm sorry. Things happened so fast that I didn't have a chance to think them through.
He put up a hand, cutting short her apology.
I may have been a bit hard on you. Gaffney told me he was the one who misdirected you.
He shook his head. What you must have been thinking in the van.
She dropped her gaze, both embarrassed and contrite.
I am sorry. It just made a lot of sense. There's a leak at the top somewhere. No one else came to mind.
He scratched the back of his head, his blue eyes fixed on her face.
You were thinking like a cop. That's what you're supposed to do. I'm not saying it didn't sting, but I'm guessing it hurt you more.
Rachel's insides tightened. Suddenly it became imperative that she not stick around to hear the rest. She searched anxiously for her purse. Lemaire's gaze followed hers. He got to it first and dangled it by the strap. Rachel stayed where she was, an ache making itself felt inside her chest. Grimly, she raised her chin and looked him dead in the eye.
Don't beat around the bush, Lemaire. Say what's on your mind.
A slow smile of appreciation broke across his face.
You've got guts, I'll give you that.
His amusement faded, and he took a step closer to her, looking down into her face.
You thought this wasn't real. You thought I was using it to keep you from finding out the truth.
His expression softened.
You've known some shitty men, haven't you, Rachel?
She shrugged, pretending indifference, though her heart was beating loudly enough to make her think he could hear it. Lemaire closed the distance between them and kissed her, cupping her head in his giant hand. When he let her go and took a step back, Rachel's eyes were closed. The pounding was now in her ears.
So what do you think? He said easily, waiting on her answer.
She opened her eyes, her breath puffed out on a gasp. It would be so easy to take the coward's way out. She'd done it with Nate in Greece. She'd known Lemaire for just over a week. It should be easier this time. Except it wasn't. She'd believed the worst about him, and he was standing right here, that teasing smile in his eyes, giving her another chance, if she was brave enough to take it.
You Francophones talk about your feelings a lot. I prefer actions to words.
His grin widened.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Then show me.
Rachel took him at his word.
Chapter 67 Issa caught Aliza by the arm as she stumbled from Rachel's room.
What is it? Why are you crying?
She rubbed the back of her hand across her face.
I'm not.
She tried to shake off his hand. He tightened his grip. He'd insisted that she and Amadou accompany him to the hospital. Lemaire had assigned Philippe Benoit to watch over them. He'd just come on shift and was waiting for Aliza nearby.
What did Rachel say to upset you?
She angled her body away from his, signaling Amadou, who was waiting at the end of the hallway.
I have to go.
Issa caught hold of her other arm and pulled her around to face him. The messenger bag she was wearing slid across her back.
Not until you tell me what's happened.
She struggled to free herself, but she didn't call Amadou for help.
Let go of me, Issa, please.
He didn't.
Aliza?
Angry tears formed in her eyes. She stopped fighting him, letting him hold her by the arms, shaken by the way his grip had changed to something gentle and protective. A silence held. Finally, she said,
Why are you doing this to me? Why are you touching me when you know?
She couldn't make herself finish. He let go of her arms at once, and a pained smile came to her lips.
That's what I mean, she said softly. You're not in this, you have Seher, but you can't seem to leave me alone.
She saw his regret,
his immediate understanding, and it struck her like another kind of pain. To bury her confession, she said,
"Rachel told me about the gun."
Now he was watching her differently, trying to assess her reaction.
"Yusuf had it for protection. He kept it on campus at our office. That's where the break-in was. I didn't think it was relevant because I didn't know you were looking for a gun."
His green eyes narrowed to slits. He didn't believe her, or at least he didn't believe she'd given him the whole truth, and she wondered how he'd learned to so easily read her secrets. Very softly, he said, "You had to know that any missing firearm